It's Monday, January 23rd, 2017. I'm Jeremiah Zimmerman, and this is episode 100 of the 5049 podcast. Thank you for joining us for another conversation between myself and another musician. Today, that musician is guitarist, composer, educator, writer, David Grubbs. It's episode 100, and it's a good one. Before we get started, I want to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who continues to check in and enjoy the show and recommend it to their friends. I sort of made mention of it last week, but this is the 100th episode, and I would spend more time up top making a big deal out of that if, in fact, I had done 100 consecutive episodes. I took about a two-year break there, and because of that, I don't feel like I have any justification to do that. But because it is the 100th episode, I just do want to acknowledge that we've done a lot of work here, and I thank all of you for taking part in it. I also want to say thanks to everyone who has signed up to contribute through the Patreon page. If you haven't already checked it out, please do. It's patreon.com/5049podcast. It's a great way to help the show. It's a great way to help me out. And if you're looking for a way to do that, please go to the Patreon, patreon.com/5049podcast. The other thing you could do if you want to help, rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. I say it every week, but it really does go a long way. So if you're looking for a way to help and you can't quite do it with money, that's a good way. Rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today on the show, David Grubbs. Now, some of you may be familiar with David through his work with the band Gastro del Sol. Some of you may be familiar with David through his solo records. He's made over 10 of them. He primarily releases music on Drag City. Some of you may know David as a professor of music at Brooklyn College. David's done a lot of things, and he's a really interesting guy. He's a great guitarist, and as you're going to hear on the show today, he's also a really great storyteller. Today's a good one, and I'm going to keep it kind of short up top. I'm a little under the weather right now, and I just want to get right into it. So if you want to find out more about David Grubbs, go to dragcity.com/artists/David Grubbs. This is someone with a very long and interesting history with recorded music. As a participant, as a writer, I think you're going to enjoy today. David's a really great storyteller. Check him out. If you're not familiar with him already, check out David Grubbs. Once again, I just want to say thank you to all of you for supporting the show as a listener, as a friend. It means a lot, and I am really proud of the fact that we are now at 100 episodes. It's a big deal to me, and your involvement in it, however that may be, it means a lot. So thank you. Thank you all very much. Okay, let's talk to David Grubbs. I lived in the South for about 10 years. I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. I lived in Nashville for a little while. I lived in Atlanta, like a few different places, and I feel like I have a good feel for the South, even though these places all have their own character.
Yeah.
Louisville, I've never been to. I've never been to Kentucky, and
Thank you, man.
But Louisville has always seemed like a real place to me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know what I mean by real place?
Yeah.
When you're growing up,
it's not interchangeable with another place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For as many unflattering traits that there might be in the South, I think there's an equal number of really charming, flattering traits.
No, I guess the way that I always put it is I'm very fond of Louisville. Maybe that's a kind of polite, that's a very Louisville thing to say.
Like,
I'm
people very are very fond polite there.
Of it. Oh, people are extraordinarily polite.
Yeah. Southern culture.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I thought for some reason, I thought you were from Chicago.
No, I lived in Chicago for 10 years. I went there for grad school.
Oh. Yeah. Do you, So,
I was there conveniently for the 90s.
It's a good time to be there.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, it's always easy to remember. Like, I moved there in 90 and I moved to New York in 99. So it's like.
That's pretty easy.
My decade in Chicago.
What year were you born?
67.
Okay. It was too bad you weren't born in 70 because then it's really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you're growing up in Louisville, I mean, what is that like for a creative young person?
Oh, my. I don't know. I wasn't around artists or musicians.
What did your parents do?
My father's a lawyer.
Okay.
And yeah, now I'm going to contradict myself. My mother is a photographer.
Okay.
But a portrait photographer who did, you know.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Did like family portraits like that. And
it's like a wedding musician.
Yeah. Related to that. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Kind of like that. Are we recording?
We're going.
Yes. But apart from that, no artists in the family, no musicians in the family. Yeah, there was not. Yeah, you know, I remember high school, what's it called? Like professional day, you know, where you go to some kind of job that you might be doing as an adult or something like that. And I wound up going to an advertising agency, and I think my parents had this thought of, like, that's what creative people do.
Huh. Right. Was it...
You know, and a friend of theirs worked at the advertising agency, so it's like, you can go to Mr. Allison's advertising agency.
Wait, do you think they were, like, actively against the life of a musician or a
painter? I just don't think... It never entered anyone's mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I think that, like, you're a creative person, like, you know, maybe you write for the newspaper or, advertise it, you know.
I mean, something similar with my wife happened, which was, you know, her parents are immigrants from North Korea. Yeah. And she wanted to be an artist, and it was, I think, a really big to-do, and their compromise, and this is what she does for a living now, was architecture is as creative as you're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I mean, I could imagine, I've, you know, played music since I was a little kid.
Guitar was the first instrument?
No, piano, like classical piano. And then I picked up guitar when I was 12 because I had this idea that I wanted to be in a rock band, that I needed to be in a rock band.
So if you were 12, what bands would have given you that suggestion?
The Rolling Stones and The Who.
Yeah.
But within a year and a half or so, it was about wanting to be in Devo or The Clash.
Okay.
Like it was New Wave.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was all about reading Rolling Stone magazine.
That was your window into
the
world.
Like, you know, after the weekly Boy Scout meeting, I would go to Taylor's drugstore and, you know, see if, you know, every other week there was a new issue of Rolling Stone magazine.
Were you able to find the things that you were reading about, like Louisville Records?
Yeah. There were two or three record stores in Louisville that stocked that stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so I was very into, like, you know, The Who and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and things like that. And all of a sudden I realized, like, wait a second, this stuff is, like, 10 years out of date, and you know, and The Who just released Face Dances, and maybe I should figure out what's going on now. And yeah, I remember very vividly reading an interview with John Lydon when PIL's second edition came out. There was like a huge feature in Rolling Stone that was, you know, one of these things where he's name checking like Dub Reggae and Van der Graaf Generator, and you know, you also got this sense of like music is an oppositional culture. You know, that it wasn't like about long live rock. It was about rock is the enemy.
There's actually responsibility.
This band, the Gang of Four, just put out a record called Entertainment, and what does that mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's up with this, you know, situationist comic on the cover and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, that's really what made me want to be in a band.
Yeah.
So almost reading about it more than anything else.
I think that's so common for people who aren't, you know, coming.
I mean, where was I going to see it live? You know,
I'd
never been
to
a rock concert. You know, like, I think when I was in my 20s, I saw Elvis Costello, and that was like the first rock concert
in
I ever.
In your 20s?
Yeah.
You didn't go to a rock concert until you were in your 20s.
Well, I mean, I saw the Babylon Dance Band at the St. Matthew's Potato Festival. In 1980, when I was 13 years old.
Festival.
Yeah, and they were fucking awesome. Yeah. You know, they were like supercharged rock and roll band.
But if you wait, if you're getting
but,
into,
but no, I didn't go to like arena shows.
You never called up your friends and said, "Oh man,
no, Devo's I think I, no, no, I think at like 12 or 13, my parents were like, "You're not going to a rock concert. They smoke pot there,
right?"
And then by the time I was 14, I would rather see, you know, punk bands from Louisville like the End Tables or the Babylon Dance Band.
Oh, so you were going to those shows?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay,
but not like rock concerts.
Yeah, yeah.
It was more like. Yeah, from around age like 14 or 15, hanging out in the parking lot behind clubs and hearing punk bands play. Because at that point, there really weren't like all ages shows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a year or two later.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when the movie The Decline played at the Vogue Theater in Louisville, and people were like slam dancing to the movie.
With The Decline of Western Civilization.
Yeah. And you know, and that the original generation of punks from Louisville were like L.A. punk. You know, just sort of like shaking their heads.
They like, did not like
what it. Is this stuff? Right. Yeah, yeah. Black Flag.
The X, you know, like, and all this.
Don't, you know, I was totally energized.
You just heard great music.
Yeah, yeah. But all these folks who were like 8 or 10 years older than me were like, you know.
I wonder if.
What is this interchangeable,
right.
You know,
I wonder,
stuff?
Do those like sort of shallow divisions still exist? Like, you know, for a lot of people, if you grew up listening to metal, you could not listen to punk.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you grew up listening to East Coast rap, it means that you hated West Coast rap.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, is this a thing still?
No, I think much less so.
Yeah.
I think people are much less. I mean, people make infinitely fine distinctions in the music that they care about.
Uh-huh.
But I think that, I mean, this is a broad statement, but, you know, the culture of listening is so much that people don't want to be caught, you know, being an asshole. You know, like, being like so dismissed. Oh, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. I think you're right. I mean, so if you were going to punk shows as a kid, when you finally made it to a big rock show,
yeah,
did you still have a taste for it, or did it kind of...
Not really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
don't know. I feel like I've never been to a big show... Like, I'm thinking, if I've ever been to a show with more than, I don't know, 5,000 people or 10,000 people that I was really moved by.
I've never.
I don't think so.
I've never.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking like, oh, I saw Radiohead in probably 1999 at some park in New Jersey. And I remember thinking like, wow, the technology for live sound is incredible. This actually sounds great, but that's not the same as being like, you know, it made me want to start a band.
Right.
Like for whatever reason that stands out as like, what a weird observation that like the sound was very good.
It's a very adult observation. It's a very polite observation.
Yeah. But I was fond of the sound.
Right. It wasn't. I had my face ripped off.
No. Not at all.
I have a friend, and he was telling me, he was going on and on and on, how he went to go see Nine Inch Nails at Barclays. And how it changed. He'd never seen a show so good.
Yeah.
And I was just looking at it, and like shaking my head. Like,
yeah.
What the fuck? I was like, what are you talking about? It was playing laptops from, you know, 100 yards away.
Yeah.
And it's like, no,
right,
man.
But the videos were like 100 feet tall.
The fireworks and the videos and the strobe lights and the, you know, the MIDI and all this shit.
But yeah. Kind of haven't had that experience.
Yeah. And I've seen Pink Floyd.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've seen them with, you know, 10,000 other people.
Right. I guess maybe the most involving thing I've ever seen in front of more than 15,000 people was when Bob Dylan injured his arm a couple of years ago and was playing
piano
on this tour. I saw him at the Barclays Center, and it was like when he played the piano, it was as loud as the rest of the band together. And it was rhythmically so wild and ramshackle. I mean, it was like Hazel Atkins playing the piano or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, like it was just really like a lurching boat in a really rough storm when he was playing the piano. And that was pretty awesome, because otherwise when he, you know, switched to guitar or wasn't playing the piano, like it was, you know,
safer.
Right as rain. Yeah.
It was, but there's something kind
it
of
was very steady.
There's something kind of enticing about the, you know, the drunk guy that might drive the car off the road.
Yeah. It was much more like hovercraft as opposed to like stormy sea.
I wish I would have seen that.
Yeah. It was wild. Yeah. It was really...
But as far as, you know, the difference between like the punk matinees at ABC No Rio as an example and Nine Inch Nails at Barclays, to me, the happy medium is, you know, the 500 seat club seeing Bad Brains.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Where, you know, the power of the show is going to murder you. You're going to get beaten down by the power of the show.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, as far as, like, punk shows in Louisville, it would be, you know, great if 50 people showed up for them. Outside of Cincinnati, there's a place called Newport, Kentucky.
Yeah.
That's now sort of like a little fancy suburb of Cincinnati, but it was just like biker bar central. It was known for the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire, which killed almost 200 people.
Ooh.
It was a White Castle test market. Like at the White Castle there, they would try out things that they didn't have at other White Castles.
Did you get to try these
things? Yeah. Like the castle onion sticks, STIX.
Sounds disgusting.
Yeah. It was like straight onion rings. Really disgusting. Like you take a bite and you get the mouthful of hot onion. It's really disgusting. And the chicken cheese sandwich. Yeah.
They have to misspell chicken because they cannot.
CHICK or IK apostrophe N.
Right.
Chicken cheese.
Right.
Rock
right,
and
right.
roll. Newport was pretty rough. And there was a place called the Jockey Club, which was where all punk shows happened. But so Squirrel Bait, which was the punk band that I was in, opened for Husker Du and Big Black. And
as a teenager?
Oh, yeah. Like when I was in high school.
You opened for Husker Du and Big Black?
Yeah.
And I take it the importance of this wasn't lost on you.
No. It was huge. Yeah.
How
it was
old
pretty
you
amazing.
Opening for Husker Du?
17, 16 or 17? I guess spring of my senior year in high school. Yeah, so I was 17.
So, I mean, that's kind of like the dream came true.
Yeah, it was incredible, you know?
Yeah. So was the idea then and there, okay, this is it, I'm starting a band, I'm going on, or I have my band, I'm going on tour?
No. No, it was like, oh, I'm going to college.
Because you had to.
Yeah, sort of. Weird idea. So Squirrel Bait was the punk band that I was in. And by my senior year of high school, we were playing, pretty regularly at the Jockey Club, playing with the Meat Puppets. And
oh, wow.
Yeah.
What year would this have been?
Up on the Sun had just come out.
Okay.
Kurt Kirkwood was selling a bunch of his paintings that looked like the cover of Meat Puppets, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they were pretty great. But, and Squirrel Bait had made a record that Husker Du offered to put out on Reflex, which was their label.
Yeah.
But we preferred, Homestead, so we put it out on Homestead. And that came out my freshman year in college.
So you were like a rock star. Where did you go to school?
Georgetown. Although I'm from Kentucky, so I have to say Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
Hey, as opposed
to Georgetown College in Georgetown, Kentucky.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't want anybody to get confused about this.
I don't know. I'm just sort of like putting myself in your shoes. And if I was experiencing that, I think I might have just shook off college and...
Yeah. No, the other people. So Clark Johnson, who played bass in Squirrel Bait, he went to Northwestern. I went to Georgetown.
Okay.
And the group was kind of on hold for a year. We played. So we did our first New York shows in January of '86.
Where were those shows?
Maxwell's. We played with Dinosaur.
Oh shit! Dinosaur
yeah.
Jr.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dinosaur.
At the time, Dinosaur.
Yeah. So, we played with Dinosaur at Maxwell's, which was incredible.
Nuts.
Really great show.
Yeah.
In front of about 15 people.
Of course.
And, our first records had both come out, like, within a month of one another on Homestead.
Huh.
And then we had the night off the next night and saw Sonic Youth open for the Necros at Irving Plaza.
Dude.
Which was... great.
Yeah.
Lydia Lunch singing Death Valley 69 in the encore. And yeah, it was pretty great. And then the next night we thought, all right, we're headlining at CBGB's. This is great. And we didn't understand the concept of the graveyard shift.
Would you play at 1 a.m. or something?
No, we played at 4 a.m.
Oh, fuck. Are you kidding me?
No. It really, I think truly it was the 4 a.m. slot. Maybe it was the 3 a.m. slot. But I think effectively we were on stage at 4 a.m.
Oh,
Yeah. No.
Was there anyone there?
Yeah, there are a bunch of people. Robert Palmer interviewed us for the New York Times, and I mean, it was cool. It was good. Yeah, Sonic Youth came. It was the one time I ever saw Thurston Moore totally fucking stinking drunk and out of control.
Really?
Yes. And he drew a swastika on a cover of the Squirrel Bait record. I mean, I think to make it look like a Manson
right,
image.
Right.
And then rather than see us like give this record to somebody else, I just remember him like opening the jacket and like spitting a beer in it. I was just like, wow, crazy.
Welcome to New York.
Yeah,
kid.
New York. It's good. It's
right.
Fun. Yeah.
Man, I don't even know what to say to that. It sounds like you knew that you were in a very special time and very special place.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For you, was it sort of like moonlighting? Like, what were you studying in school?
Oh, you know, if you're a freshman in college, you're taking, like, you know, intro to theology and
right.
stuff. You know, like, you're stuck taking...
No declared major.
Uh-uh. No, I was an English major. I went to Georgetown because I had this vague idea that I wanted to be a political journalist.
And then you got to D.C. and said, fuck this.
Absolutely. Like, you hit the nail on the head. No, when I was a senior in high school, the first Reagan-Mondale debate was in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Kentucky Center for the Arts.
Huh.
And I tried to get press credentials for my fanzine, hit the trail. And then I tried to get press credentials for my high school newspaper and was turned down for both of those. And it was the first time I ever wore a suit. I borrowed one of my father's suits and walked into the press room like I was supposed to be there and sat with the people from the LA Times. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, all right, this is, you know, I can be in punk bands and, like, you know, write about politics. Like, I could totally
do
this.
Were you a Minor Threat Fugazi fan?
Yeah, Fugazi didn't exist at that point.
Right.
I was a Minor Threat fan.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't like a total Discord freak, but yeah. Stuff was really good.
Right, right. But Ian MacKaye is real thoughtful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely person. Amazing person.
Yeah.
Total American original.
Absolutely. So your thinking was like, I can do this. I can live in both worlds and be involved with political journalism and punk rock.
Yeah. Well, I was also 17 years old, so I wasn't even thinking so much like, you know, I need to make a decision.
Yeah.
But, you know. I guess in my own kind of narrow sociocultural way, it was time to go to college.
But wait, let's go back to this. So you
I do remember trying to explain that to the person who was booking the Butthole Surfers at the time, who was like, you know, would Squirrel Bait like to, you know, possibly go on tour with the Butthole Surfers? Like, we got to go to college. Yeah, no, I know. It's ridiculous. Whatever.
I think I would have chosen Butthole Surfers.
Yeah.
But I just saw Pincus play recently. Mm, he sounded great.
Mm-hmm.
But so you were there for that first debate.
Yeah. So I was there for that first debate, and I remember walking out of the Kentucky Center for the Arts and, you know, seeing John Anderson, who'd run for president, like, sitting on the steps by himself, and a bunch of just, like, fucked up, trashy people hanging out and gawking at it. And, you know, it was just like, it was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen in Louisville, Kentucky, except for the Babylon Dance Band at the St. Matthew's Potato Festival.
Don't forget about the Potato Fest.
And, I thought, like, okay, I'll give this a shot. But I landed in Washington, D.C. in 1985. And at Georgetown, there were things like Young Americans for Freedom. And Georgetown was the number one recruiting school for the CIA.
Ugh.
And the School of Foreign Service, I mean, not only did they have young conservatives, but they were like a bunch of, you know, conservatives on the faculty. It was weird.
It's a stiff environment.
Yeah. Like I was interested in languages. So I'd taken Russian in high school. And I took Russian my first year at Georgetown, and my professor...
Yeah, you stuck with it. You can get a job today.
Yeah. I know. For years, after the fall of the Soviet Union, I thought, like, oh, you know, ha-ha, all of these, like, right-wing nut jobs who I knew at Georgetown who'd studied Russian who were shit out of luck with their Russian language
skills. Oh, they're in the money
now. Yeah, they were playing the long game. My professor of Russian was this guy... I think his first name was Leonid. It was Leonid Pirogov, who looked like Leonid Brezhnev, you know, like body double of Brezhnev.
Ew.
But Pirogov had been in like the Soviet military, the Air Force, and had stolen an airplane. And what's the word that I'm looking at? Like, you know, defected to the West, like stole an airplane. And
yeah.
It was very briefly famous as this, you know, high level Soviet military defector. So they gave him a job teaching Russian at Georgetown. He was like the worst teacher I ever had.
Really?
Yes, you're terrible.
Did you learn anything?
And pretty much everybody else in the class was in ROTC and wanted to join the CIA. And I mean, I was there to do Russian literature, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Nothing doing.
So you after that first year, left DC as fast as your feet would take you? Or?
No. I stuck it out.
You did a whole undergrad there?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I did an English major, and, you know, I was having a conversation with somebody about this last night. I played a gig, and I wound up talking with somebody who does theater for incarcerated teens.
Huh.
And so, for me, like, the Georgetown is a weird place. It was so much more conservative than I imagined that it would be. It was also so much more Catholic. I mean, it really was a religious school.
Yeah.
And, protests about birth control and student health. You know, like, yeah, there were a lot of things to be angry about there. But I will say, because I'm from Kentucky and I always say like something positive. No. The best thing about Georgetown was, or the best thing about the Jesuit tradition at Georgetown was that there was really a strong culture of people doing public service and volunteering.
Yeah.
And something like 2/3 of Georgetown undergraduates do, you know, kind of volunteer work in the community.
Really?
Yeah. And it's not only resume building. Anyway,
that's a good culture.
Yeah. Georgetown had an amazing program of teaching college classes in a maximum security prison in Lorton, Virginia, like just beyond the Pentagon.
Right.
And so I taught, you know, for 2 years. Like one was a freshman poetry and drama class. It would be a semester long class that was stretched out over the entire year
to inmates.
Yeah.
You go to the prison.
Yeah. Once a week. Yeah.
And
that was an amazing
experience. For the participants in the program, it was all level violent offenders and nonviolent offenders. And
we didn't ask.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, occasionally, like in the poetry and drama class, there was a lot of writing involved and, you know, a lot of autobiographical writing. So, you know, people would tell you what they were in there for. Primarily because I was 20 years old at the time, they would tell you with the sense of, you know, like, don't do what I did.
Right.
And it seemed like most people had robbed drug dealers. That seemed to be the worst thing you
could do, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Did you get close to any of these guys?
I saw them weekly, you know, for 2 years.
Same cats.
Pretty much. The second year was weird. The second year was a philosophy class, intro to philosophy class, that quickly devolved into, like, religious debate.
Right, you know, right.
You know,
religion gets interesting.
You might be reading Plato. You might be reading Alfred North Whitehead. You might be reading Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electronic Sheep?
Yeah.
And it was all, like, you know, this is very reminiscent of the Prophet Muhammad. You know, or this is just like the Gospels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was what the conversations frequently devolved into. Also, there was...
What kind of poets were you putting them onto?
Langston Hughes, Harlem Renaissance. I mean, I wasn't setting the curriculum.
So you weren't going...
No, there were actual...
I just read this Paul
college
poem.
No, they were actual college professors. Yeah, I was more like a teaching assistant.
Right.
Yeah.
But that had to be a pretty profound experience going into
it. It was a great experience. Yeah, it was an amazing experience.
Yeah. So it wasn't all bad in D.C.?
No. It was not all bad in D.C. Although, you know, I'm going back to D.C. twice this month, once to protest the day after the inauguration.
Uh-huh.
And I'm also playing after the Tony Conrad documentary.
Oh.
A week after that at the National Gallery.
Okay, the National Gallery. Right.
Yeah.
Wait, so when you were in Georgetown, were you able...
But I'm having all of these flashbacks to...
Have you been... You've been back since then.
Yeah.
Were you able to maintain a musical output and activity while you were in school?
Yeah. So, Squirrel Bait continued. We toured after my freshman year, made another album, and then that was basically it. And then I started a band called Bastro with the bass player from Squirrel Bait, who was in Chicago, and yeah.
What was his name?
Clark Johnson.
Okay.
Yeah. And then John McIntyre, who was later in Tortoise.
Yeah.
And the Sea and Cake joint.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
So you finish, and then you decided immediately to go to grad school?
No. The day after I graduated from college, Bastro took off for our first tour in Europe.
First time there in period, or just as a musician?
First time as a musician.
Okay.
But, 6-week tour, that really totally blew my mind. So that's like the June of 1989.
Uh-huh.
So Bastard was there for a 6-week tour, and then I think in August or September of that year, Pitch Magnet went for 6 weeks, and then Bastro.
So you were spending some time in Europe.
Yeah. Now it was a weird time being there, and like following the news of the Tiananmen Square massacre.
1989 was a big year.
I was in Germany the night that the wall
you were there
came down.
You were in Berlin.
No, I was in Duisburg and had to get up early the next morning. Duisburg's on the Dutch border.
Okay.
And I actually found out from Fugazi in Amsterdam the next day because we had gotten up really early and busted a move to Amsterdam because we were going to watch Fugazi, Warren Zevon, and this Scottish band called The Telescopes.
On one bill?
On a Dutch television show.
What the fuck?
Yeah. We were playing somewhere in Holland that night, but like we'd worked it out, you know, we'd figured out like, okay, we can go to Amsterdam and like, yeah, see Fugazi, tape this television show. But I didn't get to see Fugazi play because Warren Zevon was having some kind of breakdown and we watched him.
An emotional breakdown.
Yeah. We watched him for like an hour try to get through one song.
I'd kill to see that.
It was really one of the weirdest things that I've ever seen. Also, with the news resonating in my ear, you know, like Guy Picciotto being like, you know, they opened the Berlin Wall. Right. People are flooding in from East Germany.
That sounds like a fun day.
Yeah, it was a really fun day.
And you watched Warren Zevon.
I felt really bad for Warren Zevon. I feel like, you know, I'll have to educate myself in Warren Zevon one of these days.
Right.
Jim O'Rourke is a huge Warren Zevon fan.
Was
just recommending Warren Zevon's autobiography.
Yeah. I haven't spent enough time in Warren Zevon's world to really know what's up.
Yeah.
I kind of have like the cursory knowledge of him.
But maybe you know this song because it begins. I want to live in an ivory tower. I want to live like Michael Jackson.
I do know that song.
And then at that point, he would sort of like stop, you know, and just be like, I'm going to try that again, you know. And technicians would be like, would you like another microphone? And he'd be like, yes. So there'd be like a 5-minute break. And then he would start again. I want to live in an ivory tower. I want to live like Michael Jackson. And I have to say, at a certain point, like, the satirical edge was blunted.
Sure. By the time they had a keeper,
I was like, man, Warren Zevon is living in an ivory tower of the mind here in Amsterdam. You know, like there was something about this song that I never heard all the way through, but that presumably was about like Michael Jackson's inhuman aloofness or something like that. Huh. I found myself thinking like, you know, Warren Zevon seeming pretty aloof today.
It's kind of it's something when you see, you know, these artists who are, you know, supposed to be giants, you know, behave that big.
Yeah. No, I remember at one point Guy Picciotto saying something like, you know, next thing he's going to do, he's going to ask them to sand down the heels on his boots. You know, like this, you know, my left heel is too high.
Shit, man. So you were in Europe when the wall came down.
Yeah.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
That's heavy.
Yeah, 1989 was a pretty amazing year to be there. But also, like, we would go on these tours, and, I mean, it's kind of like just playing in rock clubs, and it would be, I don't know, I guess we would play, like, 13 or 14 nights in a row. I mean, there were not very many days off, but who wanted days off? I mean, that was really boring.
I've never wanted days off on tour. It's
no.
Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and it was also, you know, information on a need-to-know basis kind of thing. Like, I always think now, like, you know, I'm in Europe, I'm playing with other musicians, and it's like, you know, what's the info on the Wi-Fi at the hotel? You know, like, how long is the cab ride to the club? You know, like, all of these very precise metrics. You know, like, oh, you know, what's the tax withholding, you know, for a door deal in Poland and stuff like that. And this was much more like, you know, you got a fax saying like, you know, be at JFK Airport, you know, to pick up your ticket and somebody will meet you in Amsterdam and you'll be on tour for 6 weeks and you've got, you know, whatever, you know, 40 shows. And
I'd imagine the shows range from...
And maybe people got paid at the end of it or didn't, you know, like a little unclear.
Those rock tours are not...
I think maybe we all got paid a little bit at the end of it, but yeah, I mean, it was a...
Those are not the way to buy the yacht.
No. No, but I was 21 years old, so it was totally fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, here we are, you know, almost 30 years later, and it's still...
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
No, I can't... Yeah, I can't tell you, like, the Deutschmark amount of, like, free beer that I drank on that. Yeah, it's like, like, let's call it even.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Being 21 years old, on your own in Europe...
It was amazing.
Set loose.
Yeah.
Just set loose.
No, I compare that to a college education. I was like, well, you know, like, this seems to be, you know, the more profound educational experience.
Yeah. And your parents at this time were... They'd signed off. They said,
"Yeah, they were totally fine with that." They seemed very, you know, protective and the things that I wanted to do, like, you know, play at a rock show in Newport, Kentucky. That was kind of like uncharted waters. Mm-hmm. I have an older brother, one sibling, and parents always say like, "Oh, they figure stuff out with the first kid and they're more relaxed with the second kid." But I think that I wanted to do things like go on tour, you know, like I'm going to go on tour for 2 weeks or whatever in the U.S. My parents probably weren't accustomed to, you know, my older brother didn't ask. I'm going to take off for 2 weeks. Is that okay?
You weren't the sequel as much.
No. Yeah. But I think by the time I was 21, they were like, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like every step of the way, like, you know, you gave them reason to have confidence.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Chicago?
I was mainly on tour that year after graduating from high school or college. Working in a restaurant in Louisville when I wasn't on tour, fucking depressing.
Your job in the restaurant?
Well, I was a server at first at downstairs at Actors. So it was the restaurant beneath Actors Theater in Louisville.
Okay.
And I think that I was terrible at that, so they made me the host. Or maybe it's that I was better at, like, greeting people.
Uh-huh.
I think I was pretty good as the host.
Yeah. Was it a busy restaurant?
It was a restaurant beneath a theater, so it would be empty, and then all of a sudden 150 people would come.
That's
in
a really hard time to be a host.
I've done
many years in the restaurant, and when it's like that, the host job is the toughest job in the whole restaurant.
Maybe. I found the the host job pretty damn easy. Yeah. It didn't pay as well as being a server,
right?
But yeah.
You got demoted.
You know, it really felt like a demotion.
Sure.
Although,
did you tell the manager, I'm a musician, you don't get it?
No, they were not, I mean, like on relatively short notice, I would say, like, I'm taking off for 6 weeks. They'd be like, have a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was fun.
Right.
But so I applied for grad school in English and moved to Chicago.
So wait, let me ask you something about that.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know, I was an English major.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known other English majors, and quite frequently the English major is the major of, like, I don't know what the fuck, you know.
Yeah,
I like
it's
reading.
Like liberal arts major. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Was that what it was? Or?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. No, and when I went to Chicago, no, I had no idea what I wanted to do academically.
Right.
I thought maybe I would be writing fiction. And so Chicago had a creative writing option that, like, if you... So you could essentially do a creative writing degree or treat the master's as, you know, one step towards the PhD.
Uh-huh.
And it was a weird year that I was there. I never quite wrapped my brain around why this was, but there were 63 master's students. They don't do this anymore. You know, essentially, and I think most graduate programs in English do this, if you're accepted... If a school has a doctoral program, you're accepted into the doctoral program, and, you know, at the end of a year, you do a master's thesis, and you know you get your MA, and, you know, you're on your way. But you don't have to reapply for the doctoral program. But Chicago, I don't know. You know, I was interested in it, but I was also sort of like killing time, just figuring out what to do.
Yeah,
And so all of a sudden I was in this total academic pressure cooker where there were 63 people fighting for the 15 slots in the PhD program.
Yeah.
And people were, you know, desperately unhappy. And I mean, it was a really kind of weird, intense thing that I didn't, thankfully, didn't feel so afflicted by. Because
did you even have an awareness going into it that that was going to be the environment?
No. Nobody did.
Right.
But also, I mean, I was, you know, loving living in Chicago and, you know, playing in Bastro and having a good old time. You know, glad to be, you know, instead of commuting between Chicago and Louisville or D.C., like to play in Bastro. It was great. Like, you know, we practice on Thursday nights. Like, it's all good.
Yeah.
And
what was Chicago like at that time?
It was an totally amazing place to be. I mean, I'd known Steve Albini since I was in high school.
Mm-hmm. As a pen pal or?
Yeah. No, sort of. I think when I was a junior in high school, Clark Johnson and I went to go visit his brother who went to Northwestern, who knew Albini at the time. And we saw an early Big Black show at the Shanley Pavilion on Northwestern's campus. Mm-hmm. So it was Big Black and Urge Overkill.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I met Albini after that, and yeah.
And you guys stayed in touch.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a very specific piece of human.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Totally hit it off with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you traded mixtapes when I was, you know, like stuff
right.
like that. Yeah.
Right. That's a guy to talk about music with.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So you stayed in touch with Albini. Mm-hmm. You got to Chicago. You said, "Hey, man, I'm here now. Let's."
I got to Chicago. Although, then when I got to Chicago, I became much more interested in seeing jazz and improvised music, electronic music, noise.
Did you have an interest in that stuff before you got there?
You know,
I feel like because
I loved my pile of like noisy Sun Ra records and stuff like that. Like
so you were
any young
Sun Ra,
punk
right.
rocker, but I hadn't, and I saw Sun Ra play in D.C. At the 9:30 Club. But but I hadn't really gone to see, you know, free music or improvised music. You know, I saw Borbita Magus at DC Space.
I mean, that's his own thing. That's not.
I saw them on a great bill with this performance art comedy team called Rick and Mike and Bill.
That sounds like a fucked up night.
Yeah, it was really great because Rick and Mike and Bill were this very popular, ha ha, sort of like, you know, monologue-y light performance art thing, and they had a nice big, you know,
everyone came to see
Rick and Mike and Bill, and I have never seen people run for the exits as fast as
they cleared the whole room, didn't
they? Yeah, like from 100 people down to like 5 people in about 15 seconds.
Right.
That was really something to behold,
you know.
Yeah,
to say that Borbita Magus is not for everyone would be like the understatement of the century.
But yeah, in DC, I don't know, you know, I had a handful of Incus records and, you know, like Derek Bailey records and Evan Parker records, you know, like,
I mean, that's the
kind of curious about that stuff, but for whatever reason, didn't have the opportunity or like it just passed me by. I don't think that was pretty easy to come by in DC between 1985 and 89.
Right. Well, so I had Vandermark in here recently.
Yeah.
And we talked about this a good bit, how, you know, I guess he moved to Chicago probably around the same time as
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. No, I saw the very first Vandermark 5 at the Hot House.
A Tuesday night.
Probably in 1991.
Right.
Yeah.
And one thing we talked about a good bit is this period of time where there really was all these different scenes in Chicago sort of interchange, you know, interfacing with one another.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple of people, I mean, in my circle, you know, like in my run of Chicago that were, you know, people who would be a nexus for these sorts of things. So like
Jim O'Rourke
was somebody who, I guess almost immediately when I moved to Chicago, I got to know John Corbett.
Yeah.
Who does a bunch of different things, you know,
still,
like, yeah. Booked the Empty Bottle series for years with Ken, does Corbett versus Dempsey Gallery now,
publishing
Unheard
books.
Music series. He did a radio show at the University of Chicago, so I think I met him like within my first month of moving there. You know, it was one of those things like you move to town and like after like two conversations, two different people are like, "You got to meet John Corbett."
Right.
So I hung out at his radio show, you know, once weekly for you know, as long as he did that radio, you know.
Yeah,
I think probably in 98 or so.
Okay, where was the radio show happening?
WHPK, the University of Chicago radio station.
Yeah.
And yeah, through John, I met Jim, immediately started playing with Jim. Jim's Bastro had stopped and, you know, Gastrodil Soul morphed out of that.
That was how that happened?
Yeah.
Okay. What was Jim up to when you had met him?
When I met Jim, he had just recorded this duo record with Henry Kaiser.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he had just played Company Week.
In London?
In London.
Right.
Yeah. And I think there's a recording of that that's a duo record with Eddie Prevost that came out not long after that.
Okay. So he was pretty deeply involved with the European free improvisation.
Yeah. And he was also playing with all these people around the band Illusion of Safety, which was this kind of industrial...
That was a Chicago band.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who I think were like people that he grew up with, essentially.
Okay.
You know, like sort of like industrial band.
It's a great name, Illusion of Safety.
Sort of.
I mean, it's a great name for an industrial band that existed 30 years ago.
At the time, it seemed kind of ponderous, you know.
It's like, a good way to
put
it.
We all live in an illusion of safety.
Yeah.
It seemed very programmatic.
Yes. That's a good way to put it.
Jim and John Corbett knew everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, I guess the other folks that I knew that constituted a totally different scene. I started making records for Drag City around the same time, like 91 or 92.
So that label was pretty new at the time.
Yeah. They had put out, you know, a half a dozen records.
So you were there on the ground floor.
Second floor.
Okay.
Yeah.
The crawl space above the first floor.
Yeah. You know, like the first floor in Europe.
Right.
Not the ground floor, but the first floor. For whatever reason, I just had a bunch of friends in common, and they were, you know, they were putting out Royal Trucks and Pavement and stuff like that that I thought was great.
Good shit.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was in a regular poker game with Dan Koretsky and Dan Osborne, who are the two Dans who run Drag City.
Yeah.
And I got to know Mayo Thompson from the Red Crayola.
Yep.
Because, I mean...
I'm assuming that band was important to you.
Oh, the Red Crayola were like my favorite band, more or less. Yeah. I mean,
the people that are into that band are into band.
Yeah. No, there's a... I mean, yeah, this is like another story, but... someone who is a kind of intense record collector friend of mine in Louisville gave me a cassette of Mayo's solo record, Corky's Debt to His Father.
I don't know it.
Oh, it's probably my favorite record of all time.
For real?
Yeah. It's Mayo's singer-songwriter record that he made in 1970.
Okay.
It's great. That's a really stunning record. Bastro covered a song from that, and... in Cologne, this art critic guy, Dieter Stiedersen, saw us and said, oh, you know, like, you know, I'm, you know, very good friends with Mayo Thompson, who lives in Dusseldorf. You know, I'll get him to get in touch with you. You know, he needs to meet younger people and get the Red Crayola going again.
Yeah.
So I remember being back in Chicago and the phone ringing and, this... like, oh, that's an international phone
bad
call.
Reception.
Yeah. And it's like, hello, this is Mayo Thompson, you know. And I was just like, what? You know, and he was like, oh, yeah, we should do this. And I was just like, what in the world is going on? You know, and then my thought was like, it must be like 5 o'clock in the morning there.
Right. So he said, yes, sir.
Sure. So he was like, okay, when are you going to be back in Germany? I was like, oh, you know, I'll be there for shows in a couple of months. So I met him in Munich and we started working on new material. And so when I came back from that trip, at the next poker game, I had a cassette of new Red Crayola material and said to the Drag City Dans, you know, Mayo Thompson's working on a new record of Red Crayola material, but he would be interested in a label that would have an equal commitment to archival recordings and new material. And so, and that was that.
And then those dudes were immediately on board?
Yeah, they were immediately on board. Yeah. And then the week, it was either the week after that or the week before that, I'd brought them a cassette of the first stuff that Jim and I were doing as Gastrodil Soul. And they were like, okay, well, we'll do this too. So.
It all sounds really easy.
Yeah. Isn't it?
I guess. I don't know. I mean, so you joined Red Crayola.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Red Crayola are a non-membership organization.
Okay, well, but
like, you know, that was one of Mayo's distinctions. Whenever anybody would say, like, you know, the only original member of the Red Crayola, you know, because the Red Crayola started in 1966.
Right.
And I was born in 1967. And Mayo would say things like, there are no members of the Red Crayola. It's a non-membership organization.
But does the Red Crayola, are they still?
Yeah, it still exists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Him and other non-members?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, various non-members.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It happens pretty intermittently now.
Okay.
But there have been long periods of intermittent Red Crayola
activity.
So
how long were you a non-member of Red Crayola?
A while. Most of the 90s. Like probably in 92 or so, I started playing with Mayo and played pretty regularly. I mean, we made... it's always hard to sort out like what's an album and what's an EP, you know, like,
and what's a bootleg.
Yeah. we made a bunch of records for Drag City.
Yeah.
Those were great. Yeah. That was a pretty incredible experience.
Yeah. I mean,
and so the Red Crayola was happening at the same time as Gastrodel Soul.
That's a pretty good balance of things to be working between.
Yeah.
Shit, man. I feel like Chicago at the time is like, more and more, the more I hear about it, the more mm-hmm. I talk to people who were around at the time, it seems like exactly like the world I kind of wanted to live in. The world uh-huh. of record stores and shows happening at all times that people are going to.
Yeah. Yeah, no. There were amazing shows. There were amazing folks who visited regularly. Like, yeah. I just remember talking about, you know, seeing improvised music in a live setting for the first time, you know, rather than just like listening to records.
Yeah. I mean, you have to hear it live.
Yeah. But, you know, somebody like Mats Gustafsson, you know, would be in Chicago two or three times a year.
Yeah.
And I remember Ken bringing him to see Gastrodel Soul play at the Empty Bottle and me sort of thinking like, oh, you know, they're jazz musicians, you know, what would they care about this rock music? You know? Yeah. No. But then, I mean, that really started a really nice friendship and collaboration.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's...
Yeah. But that kind of blew my mind also that, like, you know, this incredible saxophonist would listen to this guitar music.
Right.
Yeah.
People love music.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think...
I had to learn that by experience.
I don't think you play that without, you know, really being an open person that mm-hmm. accepts a lot of information.
Right. No, and I found out that he was a huge Little Richard fan and
that I didn't know.
All that stuff. Oh yeah.
But how could you
Little
not
Richard
be a Little
is one
Richard
of his
fan?
Heroes.
How
yeah,
could
yeah.
you not be a Little Richard fan?
I mean, I adore Little Richard, but you know, I have
I mean the outrageous
I adore Little Richard like everybody else.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So why did you leave Chicago? Why would you leave?
Oh, for love.
Oh.
Yeah.
Shit, man.
I tried to convince her to move to Chicago.
She was living here in New York?
Yeah.
Right. Had you ever thought about moving to New York? Was it ever attractive?
Not really. Chicago had been so I finished my PhD coursework by like 1994.
You're a doctor.
Yeah.
Your PhD is in?
English.
Right.
But I finished the coursework. And I was playing music and had really interesting jobs. You know, I worked for the University of Chicago Press for a while.
Uh-huh.
And then I taught at the School of the Art Institute. And
what were you teaching there?
I taught in the liberal arts department and I taught in the sound department. I taught intro to sound. So it's like sound composition for artists
okay.
in the sound department. And in the liberal arts department, I designed two courses, one called Adapt and Survive that was about adapting literature for time-based media.
Huh.
I mean, I just kind of made it up. Not that I'd ever done any adaptations before. It sounded interesting. And I taught a course called the LP Era.
Which would...
It was like a history of recorded music.
So wait, what is the LP era? It's like 1930 to 1980?
No, like 1948 to, I don't know, like through the late 1980s.
Right.
Yeah. At the time, so it was probably in 1997 that I first taught that.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking that the LP was, you know, the LP era was a historically bounded time period, you know, that it was done.
You were wrong.
Yeah, I was totally wrong. I was totally wrong. But I wanted to think about recorded music before digital audio and digital culture.
Do you have a special fascination with that?
Yeah.
I was listening before you got over here. I was listening. I was sort of A-B-ing Doc Boggs recordings.
Oh,
yeah. Early Doc Boggs, and then Doc Boggs from like 66.
Oh, yeah.
67.
Uh-huh. Right.
Which I didn't even know existed until recently.
Yeah.
That's how dumb I am.
Now they dragged him up north.
Him up north, yeah. And you don't hear the ghosts.
Yeah.
You don't. Mm-hmm. You hear the ghosts in the early stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that early stuff is unique.
Is that, but for me, those ghosts, am I assigning those ghosts by the crackling of the record and the...
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what you're hearing.
You don't know what I'm hearing, that's right. Yeah. But...
What are you hearing? No.
I don't know. I don't think I'm a very good listener most of the time.
No, I generally, you know, like... Yes, I'm generally of the opinion that, like, I don't know what other people hear. I'm always very curious what other people hear, but on principle, don't take it as a given that I know what other people are hearing, or that other people are hearing things that are necessarily similar to what I'm hearing.
Right. Do you listen to a lot of recorded music?
Oh, yeah.
You dig it?
Yeah.
Do you...
No. I wrote a book called Records Ruin the Landscape.
It's a pretty bold title.
Yeah. That's a book about the culture of recording and 1960s experimental music. So it came out 2 years ago. It was my doctoral dissertation.
Okay.
And I teach a bunch of classes related to recorded music at Brooklyn College. And
So what is your... So let's... I want to trace a good arc here.
Uh-huh.
You came to New York exclusively for this woman.
Yeah.
And you were going to figure it out when you got here.
Yeah.
Did you know people here? Did you have people that you wanted to start collaborating with?
Yeah, I knew a bunch of people here. Although my recollection was that everybody was really busy and they were on tour all the time. So that they could afford to live in New York. By the time I left Chicago, everybody was on tour all the time because, you know, Tortoise and Jim and all these people were like in demand all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. But before that, I mean, you could just call Josh Abrams up or whoever, you know, and like, can you play on a session next week? No problem. Mm-hmm. You know, why don't you come over and we'll like play some? Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, and I found it much, much harder. Like, ooh, I'm going to be away for 2 months this fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that it was much harder to horn in on people's time here.
Mm-hmm.
But I moved here. I quit the job teaching at the School of the Art Institute. I hadn't finished the dissertation. I put it on, you know, academic cryogenic suspension because it was a degree in English, and I thought, I'm not going to move, you know, just anywhere, you know, to be a college English professor. That sounded, you know, like a thing of the past. That had been an option at one point. And I moved to New York. I was a professional musician and touring as much as I could, making records for Drag City. And my secret job was that I was a music writer for the Süddeutsche Zeitung.
The what?
The newspaper from Munich.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was like my regular paying gig.
They would translate it?
Yeah.
Okay. But you didn't want people to know that.
No. People could know it, but it always seemed much better than being like a musician critic.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, if I have to write music criticism, which I mean, did enjoy writing, but it was also to pay the bills.
Sure.
That it would be translated and it would be published, you know,
you want to keep
3,000 miles away.
Outside of your house.
Yeah. And so when I would go to Germany, people would say like, oh, the musician critic, you know.
Oh, man. Yeah. you got to be careful with that.
Yeah. So I did music full time for like 4 years and had a kid on the way and suddenly thought, I can't be on the road 3 months out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And what can I do? It's like, well, about the only actual professional skill that I have is editing manuscripts.
Right.
And like publishing.
Uh-huh.
I kind of know how to do that stuff. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I also started this PhD and, you know, almost finished it, but not quite. And, you know, maybe there's some teaching or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I set about, like, okay, on a Monday morning, I'm going to start looking for a job, you know, 5 years after moving here.
So wait, what year? You moved here in 99, you said?
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Yeah, in 2004, I was like, all right, I got to start looking for a job.
Yeah.
Kids on the way, got to find a job. And within an hour, I was on, for whatever, just, you know, like following, you know, like link to this, search for this, on the Columbia University Music Department website, there was a listing for full-time tenure track professor of radio and sound art at Brooklyn College.
Uh-huh.
So CUNY had at the time this thing called the Digital Media Initiative, where they created one interdisciplinary full-time tenure track position at each of the senior colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And at Brooklyn College, they just started a program in performance and interactive media arts,
mm-hmm.
Which is a little bit like a high-tech performance art program.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted an experimental music person for that. And I thought, oh, I know Amnon Woolman, who's this composer who had taught at Northwestern when I was in Chicago, and I knew through Jim. And, you know, he and Michael Pizarro were like the hip professors at Northwestern who would send all their students to go see the Red Crayola and stuff.
Right.
And I called Amnon and I said, you know, you teach at Brooklyn College. What do you know about this? You know, do you know anything about this job? And he said, you know, I'm on the search committee. Would you be interested in applying for this? So, so that's my job.
And it was...
Well, I had to apply, but...
Right.
but now I've had the job for 10 years.
And are you tenured at this point?
Yeah, you know, I'm a tenured full professor, and I'm on the faculty of the CUNY Grad Center as well.
And how is it?
It's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hell of a job.
Did you ever imagine that that was going to be where you... I mean...
Maybe.
Yeah, it sounds like you must have, like, imagined that you'd end up there. Or not there, but...
You know, I teaching at the School of the Art Institute was like, that was a good gig as well. I mean, in a dream world, I don't do anything except for music and writing.
That would be a dream.
You know, 100% in charge of my time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a pretty damn good gig.
Yeah.
They put me in the music department, which is weird. So the Performance and Interactive Media Arts program, which I will henceforth refer to as the PIMA program.
Uh-huh.
If I call it the Performance and Interactive Media program, I would have to shorten it to PIMP.
That's no good.
Yeah, yeah. It's a collaborative venture of five departments. It's interdepartmental, interdisciplinary MFA program. And so they were wondering, like, oh, do they put me in television and radio, or do they put me in the Conservatory of Music? And Amnon, who was teaching in the conservatory, said, oh, you can teach composition in the conservatory. It'll be great.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so they put me in the conservatory. And for the first year, like I'd never been in a music school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like teaching at the School of the Art Institute. Like, I didn't go to an art school. Like, I played in the Red Crayola. That was my art school. You know?
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, a whaling ship was, you know, Herman Melville's Harvard. You know, like the Red Crayola was my art school. So they put me in this music department, which seemed great to me, you know, because, you know, I'm a musician.
Yeah.
And that seemed like the right place you know, and somebody for whom, like, when you really come down to it, like, that's my passion. You know, like, that's what I care deeply about. You know, don't put me in the Department of Television and Radio. Put me in the music department. But for the first year, you know... I'll just describe it as incredulity, like, you know, this kind of like, what, who are you?
That was what you were getting back.
Who are you? And what, you know, like, who hired you? Because it really was this weird top down, hiring initiative from CUNY Central. Normally, you know, in the music department, the appointments committee decides things like, we need a new full-time percussion performance faculty member,
mm-hmm.
right? And they ask the administration for them. But this was a kind of weird top-down thing where the administration said, we're creating, you know, one interdisciplinary position at each of the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I got put in the music department, but I think a lot of people, like, who must have missed that monthly faculty meeting, right. you know, were essentially like, what? Who are you? You know, like, we didn't ask for you. And it's all turned out fine, but I really did have a sense at first, like, well, you know, it'll be good while it lasts. But
you didn't think that this was
going to
turn
surely into... they're going to get rid of me as soon as they can, because I don't even have a degree in music, you know. And yeah, people seemed really like concerned, you know, like, you have a degree in English.
So what was the thing? What was the moment when you were able to justify to yourself that this was a good fit?
Oh, I was never worried about justifying it to myself. I was worried about justifying it to other people. I mean, it was a perfectly interesting job for me. Yeah. So I had no problem justifying it to myself. I mean, yes, I felt like a big fraud, but everybody feels like a big fraud.
Yeah.
Especially when teaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like, you know, a new job in a new school. Yeah, you totally feel like a fraud.
Right.
I mean, yes. I really don't feel like a fraud anymore.
You've been there. I mean, you've done the work.
Yeah.
So when did it happen that you felt like, oh, this is a good fit, and other people felt that way too?
So with my degree, what happened was that I hadn't finished the PhD, and I was hired at Brooklyn College as a visiting professor for 1 year, with it turning into a full-time tenure-track position contingent upon finishing the PhD. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the dissertation that became the book Records Ruin the Landscape. So it's really, I mean, it's a cultural history of experimental music in the 1960s through recordings. So, I mean, it's a book about experimental music and media.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the basic argument of the book is that most genres in experimental music in the 1960s were predicated on the fact that they couldn't adequately be represented as recordings. So long-duration minimalism, free improvisation, live electronic music, various kinds of tech scores, mm-hmm. indeterminate musics, things like that, had to be experienced as performance, and that, you know, following John Cage, they were very proud in the fact that they couldn't accurate, you know, to any degree of satisfaction be represented as recordings. And yet 50 years later, people access this work through recordings relatively unproblematically, and that was a way of measuring the distance between, you know, listening cultures separated by 50 years.
Huh. That sounds like a...
So, I mean, it's a work of music history. Right. I just stumbled over the word musicology. I guess, you know, technically I'm on the faculty of musicology at the Grad Center, but I feel a little more comfortable describing that kind of scholarly writing as music history.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's not really musicological analysis per se.
Right.
It's you know, it's more, as I say, a cultural history of 60s experimental music, and also it's a book about technology and representation.
Yeah. What's the balance of the creative life and the academic life now?
Well, you know, ideally they dovetail.
Yeah.
And so there's a Sonic Arts MFA program at Brooklyn. So a lot of my teaching now is within that program. So teaching music composition lessons. I don't know. How does it dovetail? Also, I've just finished the second book, which is a book about improvised music. So when I mm-hmm. finished Records Ruin the Landscape, I thought, okay, the next book will be about live performance mm-hmm. and about performer psychology and audience behavior.
Oh, geez.
and it'll be a book-length poem. And so it's a book of poetry.
Have you started it yet?
Or
you...
I'm finished with it. It's called Now That the Audience is Assembled.
And what is that? Is there a published date?
There are two publishers that are reviewing it right now.
Okay.
But yeah, I would expect a year from now.
A year from now.
Yeah.
And it's a poem.
Yeah, it's a 135-page poem.
It's like some Louis Zukovsky sort of... did you...
So it's Louis Zukovsky was one of the people that I was studying when I was... Yeah.
I'm still trying to work my way through A. Mm. It doesn't work so well when you break it up over years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the book is from you. It's not, you didn't interview people and collect people's experiences.
No, it's an obsessively detailed description of a fictional solo improvisation performance.
Are there people in the audience?
Yes.
So it is fictional.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's like a full house.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that's a good night.
Yeah.
And the performer pulls through.
Yeah.
Have you done a lot of solo stuff?
No. I mean, I play solo all the time, but not improvised.
Right.
I play solo guitar shows regularly.
But you're playing songs and and compositions and singing. Do you sing?
Sometimes.
Right, it's hard.
Less and less.
Yeah. but the perspective of this poem is from the perspective of a free improvising musician.
It describes a performance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I look forward to reading that.
Yeah.
What instrument is this person playing? Guitar?
No. The person, let's just say it's not a very realistic sequence of events. Person opens a case and there's this huge spill of garbage on stage, this huge spill of detritus. Uh-huh. And for much of the book, she's improvising various kinds of invented instruments.
Huh. Okay. Sounds good to me.
You know, and at various points, the stage is invaded by, skeptical figures. There's someone who arrives with a score, who's referred to as the page turner. There's a composer who shows up at one point.
This all sounds like the demons that sit on your shoulder while you're performing solo. These sound like the demons that sit on my shoulder. I did a concert, a solo show a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. where I had like a pretty specific set of materials I wanted to work with, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of silence involved. And the second I got it was you know the back room of this bar, mm-hmm. and the second that the show started and you know people were giving me their attention, I was kept reminded of the fact. Well, these people need you know they don't this space doesn't work. I need to fill it with things. And that's one demon that shows up, or the same demon that you know pushes me to turn the volume all the way up and blow everyone out.
Mm-hmm.
Are these demons, do they appear in the book, or am I...
They only appear at the end. At the end of the book, the performer walks out of the performance space, you know, after this really testing an audience, and sees a piano sitting in the foyer and has this idea of like, oh, I'll play an encore, I'll just start playing this piano, and as people are leaving the space of the performance, like they'll happen upon me. It'll be this, you know, extraordinary moment, uh-huh. you know, like where they stumble upon the encore and I'm already playing it. And, the next thing she knows, there are 100 people kind of ringed around the piano and she's totally paralyzed and can't play the piano.
Yeah.
And that's an autobiographical moment.
What's the name of the book?
Now That the Audience Is Assembled.
Right. Shit. And are you still recording a lot of music?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Next record for Drag City. I do basic tracks at the end of this month.
What's the record?
I don't know. What do you mean?
It's a solo record? Or
it's a solo record. Eli Kessler is playing drums on it.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah. He played on the most recent record of mine.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure who else is going to play on it. But we'll do basic tracks of me playing electric guitar and Eli playing drums at the end of January.
Sounds fucking great.
Yeah.
I appreciate you coming over and talking.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Yeah.
Okay, that was David Grubbs. I hope that you guys enjoyed that. It's a lot of stories, a lot of history. I wasn't kidding about that. He's a really interesting guy, and as you can hear back there, he's a great musician. If you want to find out more about David, go to the Drag City website. That's dragcity.com. Again, long history and a lot of interesting stuff to check out. David Grubbs. Go to the 5049 website. That's 5049records.com. Slowly, I'm getting all those past episodes back up there. There's about 30 of them now, so we're making good progress. And that's it. Thanks again, guys. Thank you for being there for the first 100 episodes. It's exciting to me. It feels like something. It's very meaningful, and I appreciate it. All right. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.